All right, everyone, welcome to the Parsha End of My Life. This is Parsha Shalach, and we have a really exciting class. Although I could have just ignored this, and no one would have known, but I don't like doing that. This is a class that I gave 12 years ago. So if anybody remembers the class from 2014, by now I imagine most of you forgot, those who have been listening all these years. I don't even know if it's on YouTube. It's on our website. So I started preparing a class yesterday, and then I said, this sounds familiar. I think I taught this once. So then I checked online, and I found my class. So I said, oh, I even listened a whole hour last night to the class. And I said, wow, that's a crazy good class. And I was excited to give it over again because it's so special. And there's always a chiddush. There's always something new. So if you get to hear this a second time, that's pretty good. It's okay, even if you remember every detail. Okay, so this week is Parsha Shalach. The Torah tells us the story of the spies. The spies were sent, check out Israel. They came back. They dissuaded everybody from going in. They said, Lashon Hara, they said not such nice things about the land. They scared the Jewish people. And it ended up as a terrible catastrophe. All the Jewish people were then punished by God to all perish, all the men at least. Everybody 20 years and over, all died in the desert. It delayed going into the land of Israel for 40 years. Only the next generation, the children, went into the land of Israel. And this brings us Tisha B'Av, as we know. This was the first Tisha B'Av, sad Tisha B'Av, which is later turns into the day that the temple is destroyed two times, and many other Jewish major Jewish calamities in history happen on this day. This is one of the darkest moments in Jewish history. It was this story. It ended in an epic failure. But we need to get a little bit into the inside story to see something completely different. So I want to share with you a fascinating story. The Talmud says in Masechtas Baba Basra, Talmud tells us a story. It goes through a series. This is in Tractate Baba Basra, Daf Ayin Dalet. It goes through a series of stories that are told by one of the sages. His name was Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. And Rabbi Bar Bar Chana relates about, I think, 15 stories or something like that, between 10 and 15 stories of, like, most of them sound like fairy tales. Like, he's talking about, like, really, really weird things that he saw or happened to him. The commentaries deal with this really happened to him, or this is all more like just like visions that he had or experiences. And they're mainly allegorical. They tell you a deeper story. It's not meant to be taken literally that the story actually happened. But one of these stories that Rabbi Bar Bar Chana relates to the people to the generation of the Jewish people who died in the desert. And it's a fascinating story. So here's what the Talmud tells us. It's really two stories. Well, the first one is leading into the second one. Amar Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said, Zim l'chada, there was one time of a kozlin in b'midbara, we were traveling in the desert. Bislava Baden Ahutaya. There was this Arab merchant who was accompanying us. He was part of the caravan. So he got this whole group of people, a caravan going through the desert. And this guy was an interesting fellow, this merchant. The Avashakal Afna, he had this incredible talent or ability. He would pick up earth, Umayrechle, and he would sniff the earth, and he would catch a whiff of the scent of the earth, and he would say, this is the way. If you follow this road, you get to this city. You follow this road, you get to this, by just smelling the earth. That was his cool shtick that he had. And this takes you to that place. They once said to him, how far are we from water? They're in the desert, everybody's thirsty. So they're like, we find the Jewish people when they're going through the desert, they're always coming up, but they need water, right? So here they need, so they asked him, how far are we to water? If Amalan Havali Afra, give me some earth, give me some soil. Yavin Alei, they gave him some of the soil. He sniffed it. Ramalei, and he said, Tam the Parsa, we are 8 Parsi. Parsi is a certain measure, let's say 8 kilometers away, for example. I'm just using, that's the distance we are. Taninan V'yahavin Lei, then we waited a while. And we took more soil and we gave it to him. And he sniffed it again. He said, 3 kilometers from three parsi away from the water. Ah, so now we were just wanted to know if this guy is just pulling our leg and he's just, you know, making himself crazy, or if it's really true. What we did was af cheslei. So we started switching around the earth and playing with him. V'lo yachlislei, we couldn't beat him. He was so good. He knew exactly which was the soil from here, which was the soil from there. We saw that he's on top of his game. So this guy had some kind of an intrinsic GPS in him that he can kind of figure out wherever he is just by smelling the soil. Okay. That's like the interlude to this story, that this guy was pretty efficient in the desert. At least in that area, he knew his ins and out by picking up on the soil. Omer Lee, he said to me, maybe they had a day when they were resting, and he said, hey, he says to me, doesn't say that he said to everybody, he said to me, Rabbi Baruchana, come, you know, we can do a little detour. Let me show you an interesting site, not far from here. He said, Ta'ach vilach, come, let me show you Meisei Midbar. Let me show you a mass grave where all the people who died in the desert, where they are, where their gravesite, where they're buried. The people, again, Rabbi Baruchana is 1,500 years after the, or 2,000 years after the story of the thing. And he says, let me share with you where the people who died in the desert are buried. Azel Chazite, he came and he showed me the place. Now, this place that he showed, obviously, not everybody died in the same place, because the people were dying every year. On Tisha B'Av, they would go, the Talmud says that on Tisha B'Av, every year, no one died during the year. There was no death in the desert. Everybody lived. Those who died because of the divine decree. And they all died in the same night. It was on the anniversary of the Tisha B'Av when the spies came back and the Jewish people cried all night for no reason, or complaining and kind of rejected God. And they lost their belief in God. So those people, on that night, they were told to go dig their graves. So they had this cemetery outside of the camp. Everybody, they created a cemetery. Everybody dug their own little site. And the people whoever was alive, whoever was 20 years and up, all men, 20 years and up, by when the spies were sent, those people, all of them would get into their graves that night. They slept in the grave, and then in the morning an announcement would say, those that are alive should come out. And most people would come out, and sadly a whole group of people would not come out. Those people remained buried over there. Next year they did it again. The only ones that died were those who actually were hitting 60 that year. Although everybody had to go into their graves. In other words, this uncertainty of who was going to die applied to everyone, but only those who were at their 60th birthday, those are the people who died. Everybody else came out. So it was every year until, for 40 years, until all the people that were 20 years old and they reached 60 died. This happened Tisha B'Av. So the cemeteries were scattered all over the place because they weren't in the same place for 40 years. Actually, one place they were 20 years, but so at least he says, let me show you an area where these guys are buried. So he goes and he shows them, and he actually is not just showing them a gravesite, he's showing them the actual people. Vidami, I don't know how he got to the actual caves where the people were. Vidami commanded Mivsi. So Rabbi Baruchana now is looking and he sees that these people appear, commanded Mivsi, as if they are intoxicated. Their faces all look like they drank wine. They seem to be in bliss. They're very happy. Their faces are like, and Vagani Apargid. They're laying on their backs, they're laying upward. And after 2,000 years, their bodies didn't decay. They were intact. Their faces all appeared as if they were high. You know, they were high on some substance. That was Zakifa Birkai. And their knees, they have Zakifa Birkai Dachad Minai. We see one of them whose feet is up. And he bends his knee like this. Okay, he has his leg up like that, and his knee is bent like that. So now these people seem to have been almost giants the way they appear to be over here, because the Arab, the Ayotaya Tusa Birke, the Arab who was giving me this tour walked underneath the guy's knee. That would have been pretty high knee, because usually the knee is, you know, from when you're laying on the floor, from the torso to the knee is, what is it, about a foot. Now, this guy is maybe 5.5 feet tall, all right? 5.5, 6 feet tall. So the fact that he can walk under the guy's knee and not touch, that itself would have shown that the person was pretty tall. But it's not that. He didn't just walk under. This Arab merchant walked under the knee of this fellow while he's on a camel. So he's riding on a camel and he's riding under the guy's knee. More. And he's holding a spear. And he didn't touch him. Wow, what a long leg. Daddy long leg. Like they call the spiders the daddy long leg. This guy's got such a long leg that just when he's laying on the floor, his knees are up, the Arab riding on a camel holding a spear can ride under his leg without touching his leg. Okay. A sight to see. If you happen to be riding through the desert and you can be given a little side trip, this is an interesting sight to see. I would be happy just that by that. Rabbi Baruch Hanna, smart man. He says, you know what? These guys are the original Jews who received the Torah. So you know what? First of all, Rabbi Baruch Hanna is going to come back and he's going to tell a story like this. Who's going to believe him? Who's going to believe him? So he wants a souvenir. Okay? So what does he do? And we'll soon see in a minute why he did that even more for them, for a souvenir. What does he do? I went, he says, and paski chad karna de tchilta. I went to their tzitzit. Okay, they had a talit. They had a prayer scarf, a talis that they wore. They wore tzitzis. I went to their tzitzis, and I cut off one of the strands of the tzitzis, of the tcheles. Tcheles means the blue wool, which is part of the tzitzis, is to have this week's parsha also, to put tzitzis all the way in the end of the Torah portion. Speaks about the mitzvah of putting on tzitzis. The chad minayu from one of them. And I guess simply a souvenir. But we'll soon see in another, a deeper reason why he did it, not just for a souvenir. But I could not. And then after I took it, strange thing happened. We go back to our animals and we want to head back and the animals will not move. No matter what we try, I can't get my donkey or whatever he was riding on. Maybe he was also on a camel together with the other guy with the camel. And we could not get the animal to budge. The animal's like frozen or sealed or cemented to the ground. Amarli, so this guy is perplexed, the Arab, and he says, hey, dil meshak lamidim enayu, did you maybe take something from them? Ahadre, go give it back. The Gemiri, because we have a tradition. This Arab fella, he comes from an interesting place that he knows all this stuff, right? He must. So he says, we have a tradition. The man de shakel midim minayu, anybody that takes anything from them, loy mistagel, they cannot leave. You can't take souvenirs. It's like they tell you a lot of times by these wilderness parks, whatever you see has to stay in the park. You're not allowed to pick up pieces and take it with you, stones or whatever, plants, don't touch it. It belongs here, don't touch it. So whatever belonged in this national monument of the dead of the desert, you're not allowed to take anything from here. Fine. Now, why not? So the Mefarshim say, because it's said about the people in the about the Jews in the desert, Bamidbar hazeh yiplu pegrechem. In this desert, you will fall, and over there you will stay. So therefore, if you're taking something, their clothing is part of them. If you're taking something from them, and the Torah and the decree of God was that they're going to stay in the desert, so obviously you can't move them or any of their items from there. Maybe after Mashiach comes, and they will come to the land of Israel. But until then, everything that belonging to them has to stay. No, what did I do? I didn't have a choice. No, if it only today's days, he could have taken a selfie. Would have at least had a picture. Now he doesn't. I went and I gave it back. And then our animals unlocked. Man, just as soon as he put it back, boom, the animal unlocked and the animals were able to leave. Then when I came and I told the story to the rabbis, they probably laughed at me and said, wow, Baba Mises, you're dreaming, you're sleeping too much. Right? When I came to the rabbis, Amrali, they said to him something a little bit offensive. They said, call Abba Chamra. Every Abba, now his name is called Rabba Barbachana, but his real name was Abba. Rabbi Abba, they called him Rabba, but it's Rabba is short for Rabbi Abba. So the rabbi said to him, every Abba is a donkey. It's not a compliment when an Israeli calls you Chamor, right? It's not a compliment. They said to him, every Abba is a Chamor, is a donkey. The Chol Barbachana, Sichsa, and every Barbachana is a fool. I guess they were able to be open with him and he was able to take an insult and not get insulted. Why is he foolish? Because they said to him like this, Lamai Hilchasa of this Hachi. Why did you bother you will to take their tzitzit, to take the corner of the talis? Why did you cut it off? It wasn't just for a souvenir. It was because you wanted to come back and you wanted to show us what the halacha is. Why? You wanted to show us the original tzitzis, how it needs to be made from the original generation. If anybody knows how to do it right, it's that generation who had Moshe with them, who just got the mitzvahs from God, and he's like firsthand, you know, transmission. Later, we have arguments and this, and then you could say maybe the mitzvahs, the time, you know, they move through the generations, become a little bit, less accurate. But this was the original generation. So if you can only see their tzitzis, you will know how the real tzitzis needs to be made. And why do we need to know? Don't we all know how tzitzis needs to be made? No. There's an argument between Shammai and Hillel, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the two schools, whether you need to have three strands in your tzitzis or you need to have four strands. When we say three or four, we know we make eight, but the eight is really four doubled over. Beis Shammai hold that we need four, which equals eight, and Beis Hillel hold we need three, which equals six. This is one of the instances that the halacha follows Beit Shammai. We always follow Beit Hillel, besides in maybe less than 10 instances. This is one of them that the law follows Beit Shammai, not Beis Hillel. But so they said to Rabbi Barachana, why did you want to take the strands of the tzitzis? Was because you were going to come back and show us three or four. And you can resolve it, and it would be resolved once and for all, because we have the original ones from the people who were in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. You wanted to know, Lamei de Ike Beis Shammai, Ike Beis Hillel. If that's the case, why'd you have to take it when you saw you can't take it? You should have just counted it and come back and tell us the number. And he didn't. You should count how many knots there are and how many strings there are. Okay. That's the story. He goes on and he shows him some other pretty cool sites. This Arab shows him some pretty other cool sites. He showed him Mount Sinai, and he had an interesting vision over there as well. But we're not going to go into that right now. This is a story that is important to us today. So let's get a better insight into the inside story, because this is going to give us a mind-blowing understanding on the whole, on the significance. What's happening over here? And what's this whole story that he's showing him? He says, come, let me show you. Meisei Midbar. Simply, it means the dead of the Midbar. But there's a deeper meaning over here. The word Meisei also is used in the Torah, not just in terms of met, which means a dead person, but Meisei also can mean men. As we find, Meisei Mispar. Meisei Mispar means few people. Or in other places it says that there were big cities that had, it has a big city, Vayhi Mesav Mispar, is in regarding Moshe Rabbeinu when he gives the blessings to one of the tribes. He says Vayihim Misav Mispar, and their people should be Mispar, should be numbered, should be a big number. Or there's another verse that says Misum and women and children, Nashim V'taf, and it calls men Misum, Mem Taf Vav Mem. So Meisei Midbar meant, let me show you the men of the wilderness. What he meant to say, let me show you great people. Let me show you, not, he's not showing them dead people. He wants to show them a different type of a person. He says, let me give you a glimpse into the spiritual quality of the people of the desert. Now, before we go into the actual discussion, what we're going to see over here is that we're going to contrast two kinds of people over here. The men of the wilderness, the people, the generation of the Midbar, which this generation is the highest level of spirituality that you will ever have. Because these were the people who stood at Sinai and had a direct appearance of God. They heard God speaking, no other. What this did to their neshamot, to their souls, in terms of elevated spirituality, it will never, ever, ever be compared to it until the days of Mashiach. To have people who can excel and reach such incredible high levels of the spiritual. And that created within them such a state of elevated consciousness and such a state of pursuit of spirituality that we will never ever be able to find people with such a high caliber of connection in a very, very high level. That's one type of a person. Spiritual people. There's another people. What these people don't have is that because they're so spiritual and they're so high, they're not really part of civilization. They were floating in the heavens above. They're people from beyond. We're going to contrast them with the people that become far more materialistic, people that become far more engaged with the material world. Becoming engaged in the material world causes a person's spirituality to be enormously compromised. Enormously compromised. You can't in any way compare the level of neshama energy for a person that deals with the material world. The material world drains your energy and reduces your capacity for divine experience, for spiritual experience on levels that we can't even imagine. Yet, the quality of dealing with the world is that you're able to fulfill God's will much more. And we're going to contrast these type of people in this story as we follow. Okay. She says, let me show you the greatness. Let me show you the great men of the wilderness. What that really means is the wild men. People that are not living. The people that have attained levels to the point where they're floating above the world. These are people in the realm, in wilderness. They're above civilization. And the reason why the people in the desert were such high people, because even their food was so sublime. Was so sublime. We see the very fact that we eat is continuously creating weight that is dragging us down. The physical food coarsens a person's consciousness. That's just the way it is. It's thick, it's dense, it coarsens a person's mind. The man that the people in the desert ate was a heavenly food. It was pure spirituality. It was pure divine light. It came down together with the tal, and regarding the dew, it says, ki tal orot talecha. That dew is really or, it's light. And the man was also, it says it was the food that angels eat. It's pure godly light. The man only thickened enough, it formulated enough for it to have some kind of a texture that they can put it in their mouth and eat it. And once they ate it and they swallowed it, the man instantly dissolved and returned to spirituality. That's why, and it was absorbed in the limbs of the body, just as pure spirit. So much so that there's two things that happened. Number one, there was no waste. There was no waste at all, like all other food that has waste. And also, we know that they were always hungry. It didn't satisfy the gut. The reason why that didn't satisfy the gut, because there was nothing really that physical over there. So that's why the Jews were complaining about the man, because it was food for the neshama. It wasn't, it kept you alive, but that's about it. It didn't really create a strong gut satisfaction, a stomach satisfaction, because of its quality. But because of that, go on such a spiritual diet, you become so elevated. The soul becomes so free and so unencumbered. The earth doesn't drag you down. Now they're living in the desert. They're also outside. They're not seeing anything. What are they seeing? They're seeing the Mishkan, the home of God. They're seeing the clouds of glory. They look out of the window. They get to see Moshe Rabbeinu and the 70 Zekanim, who Moshe Rabbeinu, last week we learned, projected upon them of his prophecy. They get to see Aaron, the high priest. They're seeing such holiness. They're seeing the Shekhinah dwell. They can see the Shekhinah because they can see the cloud of glory that was dwelling over there. All day long, they have nothing else to do but to study Torah. There's nothing else. So there's no business to be involved with, no food preparation. All day long, they study Torah or engaged. If they went to Moshe Rabbeinu, they studied Torah. If they went to look at Aaron HaKohen, he lit their menorah, which means he lit their souls ablaze, and they went into deep meditative prayer. They went into deep meditations and to deep spiritual trances. Imagine, these people remembered Sinai. They saw it, they experienced it firsthand. So whenever they closed their eyes and went into a meditation, the God wasn't something that it took a very long time that they can reconnect to. They had a memory. They can literally, in 2 minutes, they can be in a state of absolute dvekus, in such an incredible state of cleaving and connection to God. It's unbelievable. And they're the first people doing mitzvot. So it's like every mitzvah is like the most exciting thing imaginable. You know, putting on the tefillin, keeping it. It's just incredible. So in that state, and again, there's no distraction. There's no impurity. There's no billboards over there. There's nothing unkosher for them to see. Everything is kosher. Everything is holy. Everything is godly. And they're marinating in this for 40 years. What happens to their bodies? What happens to their entire, their spiritual beings floating on earth? Hardly anything here to anchor them down. Now, that's why it actually says, that these are people. It says there's an argument to the Gemara, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, if the people who the generation of the desert, if they have a portion of the world to come. Rabbi Akiva says they were punished in this world, but they're all going to Gan Eden. They're all going to have a portion of the world to come. And I'm sorry, Rabbi Akiva says, Ein lem chelek l'olam haba. They don't have a portion of the world to come. Rabbi Eliezer says they do have a portion of the world to come. But even according to Rabbi Akiva, that says they don't have a portion to the world to come, it's explained in various different places, the Megala Mukot, the Rama Mepano, and so forth, that it doesn't mean they don't have a portion. It means, because they don't go to Olam Haba, it means they don't have a portion of Olam Haba, because they're bigger than a portion. They're so plugged in to Olam Haba, that's not like a little slit. They don't get a little slice. These are such high elevated people that they go way beyond everybody else in the world to come, in Olam Haba. So now we understand when he says that when he got to see these people, he immediately looked at their faces and he sees they're in ecstasy and they're in bliss. So Tosfos actually says in the Talmud, from here you see that this Gemara seems to be proving the fact that they do have a portion of the world to come. Because if they wouldn't have a portion of the ground, why are they laying over here in a deceased state and they're so happy? In other words, by looking at them, we can see that they're in a very good place, and it's reflecting even in their bodies that they left behind in this world, that their soul, because you know that the soul remains connected to the body to a certain degree, even after it departs. So that they must be, if they would be in a dark place, then they would be wincing. Then you would look at their faces and you would see there's a lack of joy there. The fact that they're laying over there and their faces are so relaxed and are in so content and in a state of such satisfaction and joy is an indication that they're in a very good place. But what is the deeper meaning? That they are intoxicated. They're on high. What are they on a high from? They weren't drunken. They didn't have any drugs or anything like that. Why were they so high? They were high because we know that the secrets of the Torah are called wine. Yeno shel Torah is called water, and Torah is also called wine. The water side of the Torah refers to the Torah that descends low, that becomes part of the application of the Torah to the physical world. Yeno shel Torah, the wine of Torah, are the secrets of the Torah, which means like wine. What's wine? Wine is inside the grape. It's hidden. We also know that wine, what is the nature of wine? When you drink wine, what does wine do? Nichnas yayin yatsa sod. When wine goes in, the secret comes out. Yayin is also gematria sod. Yayin is 70 and sod is 70. So wine is all secret. So these people that were in the desert, the first generation to receive the Torah, they didn't only study Torah in its earthy application. They were phenomenal Kabbalists. When they studied the very same halacha that we're studying, they can see deep, deep inside to the deep secrets of what's the inside story, what's really taking place. And because of that, they were drunk with the knowledge of the esoteric elements of Torah. And when you're drinking the secrets of the Torah, it awakens in a person such a spiritual drive, such a passion for more, and a desire to have greater revelation. And that's the meaning of these people radiating ifsimi. Their faces were commanded ifsimi like they were drunk. Like the Talmud also tells us that we in the famous story that Rabba and Reb Zera once had a Purim meal together. Talmud, fascinating story. The Talmud says that Rabba and Reb Zera had a Purim meal together. And Rabba got up and he slaughtered Reb Zera. He v'shachtele Reb Zera, and he shechted Reb Zera. You read the story simply, it seems like these people are behaving like two peasants in a bar. These are the great rabbi. Get a little drunk, and one pulls a gun and shoots the other. God forbid that Rabbi and Reb Zera, okay, they got a little drunk, but still, what kind of behavior is that? So the Rebbe explains that when it says that Rabbi and Reb Zera got drunk, it doesn't mean they got drunk on wine. They drank wine because it's a mitzvah. But what the real drunkenness was, they started pouring secrets and secrets of Torah. And suddenly, it became so intense that Reb Zera couldn't handle it. His neshama couldn't handle it. Rabba had a much greater spiritual capacity than Reb Zera. Because Rabba in Hebrew means big. In Aramaic, Rabba means big. Malashon Rav, big. Zera comes from the word Zeira. Zeira means small. So Reb Zera had a much smaller capacity than Rabba. So when Rabba and Reb Zera were sharing the Purim meal together, and Rabba was downloading onto Reb Zera such secrets, it reached the point Reb Zera couldn't handle it. And what happened? His neshama left his body from pure ecstasy and bliss, pleasure that the body can't handle. The same story like the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, that bekarvasam lifnei Hashem, they came close to God, vayamusu, when they died. When they died, it was because their spiritual ecstasy was too intense. And one of the opinions that the Talmud says, why did they die? And it also seems so from the verse. It says, shtuye yayin nichnasu. They went in drinking wine. So the deeper meaning of that is, as explained by the Arachayim and by many others, when it says that they went in drunken, which means they became intoxicated by the deeper knowledge of Torah, by the secrets of Torah, which gives you access to the powerful light of Hashem. And when you come into such proximity, the neshama cannot hold the body, and their body left. So similar to that is the state of this entire generation. They're all laying there on the floor, on the ground, and their faces are in a state, because this is the lives that they had for 40 years in the desert. These people were living in pure drunkenness. Now I'll take you back to, as it's explained, why the Meraglim did not want to go into, why the Meraglim came back. We always have just such a bad story about a taste on these Meraglim. What's with them? What were they afraid after you went out of Egypt and you saw such miracles? Obviously, you know God is above nature. So what are you afraid to go into the land just because there's some giants? It's explained that the physical fear was just a derivative. It wasn't the real fear. What really scared them was spiritually. And we discussed this a million times. They were scared that they would have to leave this incredible spiritual existence of the desert and they exchange that for everyday earthly living, where they're not going to be able to spend their time studying mysticism and engaging in meditative prayer for hours and hours. They're going to have to get out into the farm, plow the fields, engage with the world. And they realize that the Eretz Ochelet Yoshveha, it's a land that's going to eat up the dwellers. That means the earth is going to swallow them. They are going to become earth people. They're going to lose all sense of connection to Hashem. And they dreaded that. It came from a very good place. They wanted to stay in this elevated consciousness, in this incredible, enlightened state of desert existence. So those were the Meraglim. Now, imagine, they got what they wanted. God did not take them into the land. He let them. He spoiled them. He indulged them their desire. And they realized it was a mistake, as we're going to soon see, that as great as it is, it's not God's desire, and therefore, as far as you go, it's limited. We're going to get to that. But the point over here is, when he's looking at these people, he sees them in the highest state of ecstasy. And that's why it actually says they were laying on their backs with their faces up. Rashi says, Ganiyar Pargi, they're laying on their backs, their faces up. What does that mean? Their face is upward. The face represents in Hebrew, face means, in addition to face, it also comes from the word panim, which means inside. The reason why a face is called panim is because when you look at a person's face, you can see what's going on inside them. So if I'm looking at someone from their back, I can't tell if they're happy, if they're sad, if they're anxious, if they're relaxed, if they have a lot of pain, or if they're in a state of bliss. When you look at a person's face, you can say, especially in the eyes, everything can tell you about a person. So the face is the window, eyes are the window to the soul to get to see what's happening in the inside world of a person. So pneia means their face, means their pnimius. These were people whose pnimiut were all lamaila upward. Like it says, El mul pnei ha-menorah ya'iru shiva saneros. We discussed it last week. Remember the class last week? We said that all the neshamot, all the souls, which are the seven flames, should be burning towards the center of the menorah, which means pnei ha-menorah, that's God himself. So this represents people who had no other desire and want other than connection to God, although they were physical people still attached to a physical world. To a certain degree, they had to engage in some physical material existence. To a certain degree, they had to pack their suitcases when they were ready to leave. They had to brush their teeth or whatever else they were doing. But their heart and soul was never there. Their heart and soul was in one place and in one place only, in their connection to Hashem. That's the meaning of Pneum Lamayla, which also explains another part. It says they were laying on their backs. We know, according to Halacha, you're not allowed to lay on your back. A person is supposed to go to sleep. You're supposed to sleep on your side. On your side. And from the Halacha, it seems to imply that you're supposed to have so much self-control that even when you're sleeping, it says the first half of the night you should lay on one side, and second half of the night you should turn over on the other side. So I guess you can, if a person is a real Yirat Shamayim, you can program your body that even when you're sleeping, you should be conducting yourself according to the Shulchan Aruch. But it's not okay to sleep on the back. Now, you're not supposed to lay on your belly, and you're also not supposed to lay on your back. So the question is, how are these people laying on their backs? Yeah, the simple answer is they were buried. It's only when you're alive you're not allowed to. These people were. Tosfos actually says from here you see that when you bury someone, you bury them face up. Because you see from this story that they were buried facing up. But the problem over here is, no. Tosfos says, one second. So Tosfos says you can't, but Tosfos says you can't prove from here that you're supposed to bury someone with tzitzis. You can't prove from it. Why? Because these people went into their graves when they were still alive. It's not like they buried them after they were dead. Everybody went in, and then they were going to wear tzitzis. They weren't the last night of their life, possibly. They weren't going to sleep without tzitzis. And then they were left with the tzitzis. So what do you see from here? That the position that they were in was a position that they laid themselves down while they were still alive. If, according to halacha, you're not supposed to lay on your backs, why were they laying on their backs? The answer is, the reason you're not allowed to lay on your back is because it could create within a person not good thoughts. It leans into impurity. But that's only people that have some kind of coarseness. Because of the coarseness, we're afraid that it's going to cause them to become defiled or whatever. But because these people were so spiritual and so high, their faces were above. That means they were in such a meditative state. There's no problem. The whole chashash of sleeping on your back didn't apply to this generation. These were very big tzaddikim. The whole generation were tzaddikim. They were elevated people on a complete different level. All right. Now, when it wants to say to what degree, that means even when we think, okay, they were high, but in order for us to appreciate how there is no comparison to them, any generation living after them is a generation that has been dropped into this world, that God put into this world to engage with this world, and being engaged with the material world desensitizes, causes such a fall on the neshama that we can't begin to compare to them. So in order to illustrate that, the Talmud tells us the next thing. One of these people were laying and his foot were up and his knee was bent over. Okay. Then we hear the story that the Arab merchant was riding on a camel and he was holding a spear and he could not touch the leg of this individual. What is that part of the story trying to depict to us? That part of the story is telling us something really, really amazing. How uncomparably high these people were in terms of their spiritual attainment and their level. We're contrasting these wilderness people to people of civilization. That means people who live in the world, not people that live above the world, but people that live in the world. Now, we're going to compare them to the best scenario of who? Of a person who's living in the world, who is engaging with the material world, but does not allow the material world to get to them. While they're alive, they keep themselves as spiritual as possible. In other words, we're going to compare the highest level of a civilized person to the lowest level of these wilderness people. We're going to compare the lowest level of these wild men of the desert is their feet. The feet is the lowest part of the person by the ground. We're going to talk about the height of the feet, which means the height of the lowest level of these wild men of the desert, and going to compare them to the purest, greatest possible person whose living in this world, dealing with this world exactly according to God's plan, doing exactly what they need to do, yet because you're engaged in the material world dampens your soul and dramatically reduces your consciousness to become soiled and darkened. I'll tell you an interesting story. The holy Baal Shem Tov was once, there was a lady who used to come to the Baal Shem Tov, and she would bring the Baal Shem Tov, help support the family of the Baal Shem Tov. She would bring, I think, food and stuff. She was a very special woman, and she would come to the Baal Shem Tov's house, and she would provide a lot of. And of course, the Baal Shem Tov blessed her. One time, during her travel to the Baal Shem Tov, back from the Baal Shem Tov, she passed through a river crossing. She didn't estimate the power of the river during that time. She fell and she drowned in this river. And the news got to the Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov was very upset. He was very upset that this woman died. And the river, so the Baal Shem Tov decreed upon that river there should never be any water there. He expressed himself that there should never be water running in that river again. So the angel of the river, because every element in this world has a spiritual malach, went up to God, says, listen, I have a right to be here. Who's the Baal Shem Tov here to mess with my Sebereshis? If God decreed that there should be a river over here and the Baal Shem Tov is messing over here, he has no right to do this. I just heard a story in a story. They once asked the Baba Sali, how come all of his blessings are fulfilled? How does he have such an incredible ability, Rabbi Yisrael Abba Chatzera, that all of his blessings are fulfilled? So the Baba Sali answered, the Mishnah says, simply it means when you're drinking water, so water is tasteless. And the real enjoyment of water is really when you're thirsty. So there is an opinion that says that if you drink water and to take a pill, if you're drinking water, you don't have to make a blessing because you're not drinking water and enjoying the water, really. If you're drinking orange juice to take a pill, it has a taste. So you have to make a blessing even if you're doing it to take down a pill. But if you're drinking water to take a pill, you don't have to make a blessing. But if you drink water when you're thirsty, you do have to make a blessing. The Baba Sali said like this, the deeper meaning. Mayim is Torah. Any person who's thirsting for Torah, that means who learns Torah with thirst because their soul is burning for God, and through the Torah they're absorbing godliness, that's a tzaddik. Someone who learn every time they learn Torah, they're feeling, oy gevald, I'm connecting to Hashem, and with such thirst, mevarech, they are able to mevarech, they can give a blessing. Which blessing? Shahakol niya bidvaro, that everything happens through their words. That the blessing that this tzaddik gives is mevarech. Its blessing is that everything the tzaddik says happens because they drink water. He was talking about himself, that when I study Torah, I'm very thirsty for the Torah. So if Baal Shem Tov decrees there's no water in that river, so then there's no water in the river. So they tell the angel above, well, the Baal Shem Tov has veto power. He can, tzaddik goes there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim. The tzaddik can decree. And therefore, they had to appease, but still, it's not right for a tzaddik to mess with such things. So in heaven, they were a little upset at the Baal Shem Tov. So they decreed that the Baal Shem Tov was punished. They listened to him, but at the same time, he was punished. What was his punishment? His punishment was that one of his children would pass by, even though there would be no water over here, when one of his children or grandchildren will pass, there will be a flash flood, sometimes has a flash flood, and his own family member will die, drown in this thing. A punishment for messing with God's plans. You know, Hashem set it up one way and the Baal Shem Tov set it up another. The Baal Shem Tov found out about it and he warned all of his children never to pass over there at that place. And they obeyed. One time, the Baal Shem Tov's son, I think, Reb Tzvi, was passing, was a little bit, you know, maybe traveling somewhere, and his mind wandered off and he wasn't careful and he ended passing this. And as he came there, a sudden flood. He was thrown into the water and he was drowning. And he realized what happened and he cried out. And he cried for his father. His father had passed away. The Baal Shem Tov had passed away. And he cried for his father. And he suddenly saw a flame in the water that was carrying him away. He sees like a flame. He reaches for the flame, and that was like a depiction, a vision of his father's neshama, and that kind of pulled him out of the water, and he was saved. The Baal Shem Tov then came to him in a dream, and the Baal Shem Tov said to him, I came down to rescue you, but please be very careful, don't ever do this again. I told you not to travel there, because had I known how dark this world is, I would not have come down. In other words, the fact that I came down even here for 10 minutes to pull you out was so painful for my neshama to have to breathe the oxygen of, you know, every neshama is sent into this world that says against your will you're lived. Every neshama comes in. And when we're here, it looks beautiful. It's so, but this, the Baal Shem Tov says, I volunteered to leave Gan Eden, Olam, in the worlds of light, to come down into this world. I can't breathe. I almost died out of a... As an neshama, come, I came to rescue you because you called for me. But please don't do it again because I can't bear doing this again. Once was enough. I'm using this as an example to tell you how thick and dense this world is that we don't even realize it. So the Arab merchant riding on a camel holding a spear is a depiction. We'll see each step is a depiction of a person who's dealing with this world, but is on the highest possible level you can possibly be while dealing with this world. What is that? First thing is he was a merchant. What's the idea of being a merchant? What does a merchant do? A merchant wheels and deals. You buy merchandise, and that merchandise now goes out when you're purchasing something. The object was once not belonging to you. Let's say, you know, I bought whatever it is. It once belonged to someone else, and now the person purchased it, it becomes theirs. Spiritually, what that means is our work in this world is to be, so what I'm saying is that you don't physically change it. You're not altering. When you buy something, when you go into a store and you purchase a pocketbook, when you purchase a hat, you're not altering the hat. You're not altering the bag that you bought. The only thing that's changing is changing ownership. So spiritually, what that means is our job in this world, like God sends us, is to purchase everything in this world, not to change it, to keep everything in this world as it is, which means not to change its essential physical properties, but to bring it into God's domain. That's our work. When you make a bracha, for instance, on a glass of water, this object, this entity was once outside of God's domain. Not in truth, in essence, not, because Hashem is everywhere, but it wasn't openly related to Hashem. It belonged to the public domain. Now that I took possession of this and I make the blessing, blessed are you, God, Lord, the King of the world, that everything was created through your words, Shakol Niyabed Varo, everything was created through your words, came into being through your words. I just proclaimed God's dominion and ownership over the water, and I now brought this from the public domain into the private domain. The reason why God sends the Jewish people all over the world is to act as merchants. We go out and we're business people. We're buying and purchasing all the real estate of the world. Everything in this world is being included into the oneness. And then when Mashiach comes, the entire world is no more a public domain. It's a private domain. It all belongs to the singular God, and we're all part of his empire. All it. That's why the land of Israel is called Eretz. We begin with the land of Israel. Through the land of Israel, then we spread through the entire world. The land of Israel is in the Torah referred to many times as the land of Canaan. Canaan means a merchant. Like we find that Yehuda went and he married Bas Ish Knani, Ushmo Shua. Yehuda went and he married the daughter of his wife Shua, who's the daughter of Ish Kanani. Rashi says, Ish Kanani Socher, a merchant. So Kanani means a merchant. Eretz Canaan means a land of business. We go into the land of Canaan and we elevate earth and we bring it into holiness. This person that the Talmud is speaking about, this Arab merchant, he was a merchant. That means he wasn't living his life in the material world, forgetting about his purpose. Every single thing he did in the material physical world was to bring it into a relationship with God. He fulfilled what, not only did he learn Torah and do mitzvot, he also fulfilled what's called Kol Masecha Yeh L'Shem Shemayim. Whatever you do should be for the sake of heaven. And also Bechol Derechecha, in all your ways, they Ehu, you should know him. So this guy, he's not a person who forgets his purpose in this world. He's a merchant. He's doing what he should be doing. Not only that, he was riding on a camel. Riding, the animal you're riding on in this depiction represents the body. The person riding is the neshama, the soul. The animal you're riding is the body. And there's different types of animals. There's a donkey, there's a camel, all kinds of animals, there's a horse. A camel represents a very, very refined animal. Why? Even though a camel is not a kosher animal, the Talmud says about camels that camels are very tzniastic. Their intimacy is done in a way that is very not noticeable when the camels are. So that represents a more refined physicality. Talmud also says that someone who sees a camel in their dream is a sign that they were almost supposed to die and Hashem saved them. What spiritually that means is that they're similar to the Nadav and Avihu, whose soul were ready to leave. Dying over here means soul cleaving to God, and they almost died and they were sent back, which means a person whose physical body is not so coarse that it's pulling him down. Quite on the contrary, the body allows the soul a lot of free rein. So when the neshama wants to flap its wings and fly up, it can almost die and be saved. In the end, Hashem holds the neshama back and sends him back in the body. So what it means, it's someone whose body is not a vicious animal trampling on the neshama, but quite on the contrary, a very, very refined animal. So you have a person who's number one, his engagement with the world is he's constantly doing business, which is the right way to deal with this world, spiritually doing business, elevating the world. His body is a very high body. His body is a camel, which is very tzniutik and very refined and modest. Finally, he was riding and holding a spear, a romach. The Zohar says that romach is indicative of the Kriyat Shema. Because romach is resh mem ches with a vav. Resh mem ches in Hebrew, the Hebrew letters resh mem ches is 248, which represent the 248 mitzvot. So the Zohar says there are 248 words in the Shema. Because they're the root, the saint reciting in the Shema is the root of all of the mitzvot. But in addition to the 248 words of the Shema, there is 6 words in the first pasuk. Shema, Yisrael, Hashem, Elokeinu, Hashem, Echad, which encapsulates the whole Shema. Those are the 6. A romach, a spear, represents the recitation of the Shema. What's the highest point of a person's day? When is the most spiritual moment of your day? When are you the least engaged with the gashmiyot of this world when you're praying. Prayer is a time when you elevate yourself. You step away, you wash your hands, you put on a gartel, which represents a separation from the world if you're a man. You disconnect. For a man, you put on talit and tefillin. You disconnect from the world. In the prayers itself, what's the peak of connection? The whole prayer is surrounding the Shema. The Shema is the state when you're declaring Hashem's unity. It's the moment of Mesirat Nefesh. Va'aftas Hashem Elokecha. Love God with all your heart, all your soul. It's like the highlight, the peak of spirituality. So now let's take a look at who this Arab is. You have an Arab merchant. He's a merchant, which means he's not, going back, he's not an indulgent, materialistic person who's forgetting about his purpose. He's dealing not with a coarse, heavy body. He's got a camel body, a very, very elevated body. He is saying the Shema, which means he's at his highest peak in his roaming the earth, in his life on earth. This is the moment when he's almost touching heaven. This is his highest moment. Rosho Bashamaima. It says prayer is like a sulam mutzav arza, the Zohar says, like the ladder that's on the ground, Varosha Hashamaima, and the tip of the ladder, which is by the Shema, you are actually touching the heavens above. But since you're a merchant, your feet are on the ground. So we're saying like this. A person of civilization, a yid, a Jew, who deals with the gashmiyut of this world, who's engaged with material world, at his highest moment, imagine Yom Kippur by the Ne'ilah, that's the highest moment. He's walking under, and he cannot even touch the feet, which is the lowest moment, of these men of the wilderness. This is just giving us the perspective of what kind of people it was to live 40 years with Moshe Rabbeinu, surrounded by the clouds of glory, living by eating man from heaven, drinking from the well of Miriam, in living literally in miracles, seeing, having spoken to God at Har Sinai, experiencing the going through the waters by the Yam Suf, which says they had the higher levels of Nevuah than the biggest prophets. I mean, going through that elevated people to such a level that their lowest moment is higher than our highest moments, even of the best of us on the best day. The best of us on our best day, at the highest moment of our best day, cannot come to the just an average guy who lived in the Midbar to the feet of that person, which means the lowest element of that. That's how awesome these individual people who were in the Midbar, whose faces are facing upward and are intoxicated with godliness. So Rabbi Baruch Hanna says, pretty awesome people. So I want to go and take a little bit of their tzitzit. Because Rabbi Baruch Hanna is thinking, I wish I could, I'm envious of these guys. They were so connected. They are so high. I got to go back. He sees their level and he says, I'm going to go back into the regular world, deal with the material world, the world that these people didn't want to deal with. That's why they stayed in the Midbar, but I do got to go back. Let me take something with them, from them. If I take a souvenir and I hold something from them, perhaps it's going to help me that when I get back into the material world, I'm not going to drown. It's not going to kill me. So he chooses from anything he can choose from them, he chooses the techelet. He takes the tzitzis, he takes the tzitzis. Now, one of the things about tzitzis is that tzitzis is supposed to remind us about God. That's the reason we have them on the four corners. It says this week in the parsha, Re'isam Oysa Yizachartam. Why do you have to remember? Because you're living in a world that can make you forget. Everything in the material world makes you forget Hashem. Instead, it substitutes. Instead of godliness, you see materialism. So it causes us to forget. So you need a reminder. That's in general the tzitzis. The techelet in particular, the Zohar says techelet is from Lashon Tichla, v'ishtaitzi, which means it burns. That techelet is the same color of a fire. When a fire burns on a wick, you can see there is the bright fire, and then next to the wick, right above, is a dark fire. That's the color of Techelet, is the bluish, darkish color that's next to a fire. Why is it that color? Let's look at a fire. Why is that? If fire is bright, why is it next to the wick dark? It's dark next to the wick because that part of the fire is taking the wick or oil or whatever the fuel that's being combustuated and converting into fire, converting something that is not fire into fire. It's taking the higher part of the fire is just fire, pure fire. The lower part of the fire is the converted substances that were once not fire that have now given away into the fire. Spiritually, what does that mean? There is a power in our neshama that can burn away at the gashmiut. At the gashmiut. What does that mean? That each and every one of us has to have within ourselves a certain intolerance. Because we're living in a gashmiutiga world, we need to recognize that, you know, we have to have alarm go on when there's something that might cause us to slip and to fall. We have to like say, no, I don't tolerate that. That zelo, zelo de bishumafan lo. Like there's no way this is happening. That's like a strong rejection. That's the techelas puts into the person. A sense of that. And that's where it keeps the yirat shamayim, the fear of God, that keeps us imbalanced, or else we can become completely lost in our material involvement. So this guy says, from anything I'm going to take with them, I'm going to take this techelet, and I'm going to take it with me. Imagine how much they did not tolerate the gashmiut. They were so spiritual, they took one little smell because they were going to stuck their noses in Israel, and they realized they're going to have to sink into gashmiut. They said, Bishumof and Lo, we're not going there. Which means their level of intolerance was very, very high. So he says, and that's the tchelas of the tzitzis. Let me take a little bit of theirs. It's going to help me keep my balance in my own life. Because once I see how spiritual they were, I want a little bit of that. Like we know big tzaddikim, for instance, they would salt their food very much so they don't taste it. Because they knew that once they start enjoying the material taste of food, it's going to coarsen them. It's like an intolerance. I cannot tolerate having the pleasures of the physical world because the physical world's pleasures might seduce me into unholiness. So that's the nekud of the tchel. He wants to take along. What happens is he gets onto his donkey and the donkey doesn't move. So what's the meaning? The meaning is, if you're holding on, that their level of intolerance was so strong that when the donkey wants to go back towards, when they're turning around and leaving the desert and going back to civilization, it's not allowing that to happen. Their level of intolerance was so strong that it would not allow them at all to make their way back into the civilized world. Similar, and let's give an example to this. Similar to Reb Shimon Bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Elazar. We know that they were in a cave for 12 years. Withdrawn from the world, sitting and studying Torah, and all day long their minds were, and then when they came out of the cave the first time, what happened? They saw people that were plowing their fields, they saw farmers, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, everywhere they looked, they were burning. Because they had intolerance. They couldn't understand. They said, people, you're alive. You have a chance to study Torah. You have a chance to connect to God. And you're busy with such shtuyot. You're busy with such narishkeit. It's such ridiculous things. They couldn't tolerate. That's why they burnt wherever they were looking. This is the idea of when you're holding on to their tcheles, it's going to cause you to cause a fire wherever you're going. You're going to burn the world up. It doesn't work. You got to make a choice. Either you take some, either you stay in the desert or you're going home. You can't bring their non-tolerance to gashmiut is not going to allow to come into the world and live amongst people. You're going to become such an extremist. You're going to become such an intolerant person that no one is going to be able to step into, you know, walk into a 3-mile radius around you. because of the intolerance of like how, like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai coming out and he couldn't deal with the world. So just like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, what was he told? Go back into the cave. Go there and then come out. This is exactly what he was told. Go back and give them back the tchelet. That's what Reb Shimon Bar Yochai also did. He had to go give back the tchelet. He had to go put whatever he's taking with him in the cave, leave it in the cave and leave that behind and come out without it. Here too as well, leave that behind. Now the merchant says, but the merchant comes and says something much deeper. He says, if you're holding something from them, Gemiri, here's the whole point of the whole class is to get exactly to this point. He says, Gemiri, we have a tradition, which means like this. I'm not going to tell you something that makes sense now. He wasn't going to explain in a sensical manner why if you're holding something from theirs, you can't leave. We just have a tradition. So we are told that if you take something from them, you can't, your animals lock, you can't leave, you have to. And what is it? That anybody that holds something from them, you're not able to move. Lelech, you can't move. What is the deep meaning? Here in all lies the entire lesson in this whole class. It is so awesome how high these people were and how spiritual these people and how godly these people were in such a high level. But they cannot move. Those people in the desert, they're not called mahalchim. It says about the angels. You know what they are? They are angels. The people in the desert lived a life of angels. And angels are called atzei shitim omdim. They're called like the shittim wood that stand. It says in the pasuk in one of the prophecies, it says, "V'nasati lecha, I will make you mahalchim, mobile beings, walkers, goers, beina oimdim elu amongst these stationary beings." Hashem says to the neshamot, to the souls, He says, "I will make you into movers amongst those who cannot move and stay in one place." What does that mean? The angels are considered people who entities, spiritual beings who stay in one place. What does that mean? Of course, angels have wings. They fly. But even when they fly, wherever high level of spirituality they reach, it's considered that they never really left where they came from. They're still within. Why? Because they remain within the same context. They remain within a certain framework. Why? Because they're created beings. And when you're created a created being, you have a limit. How much you can understand, how much you can expand, how much love can you have, how much greatness can you with? It always has a limit. The only one who's not limited is God. The only way to break out of all limitations and to actually go somewhere, going, real inyan of mahalich means to move, and to move really means to go away from where you are to somewhere else, which can only really mean if you're going outside of the framework completely, to get completely outside of the contextual framework of time and space or whatever structure one is in. There's only one way to do that, is if you can hop onto God and God can take you beyond all limitations and all boundaries. But the only way you can hop onto God and go where is if you listen to His mitzvot. And Hashem's mitzvahs are all in the physical world. In other words, as long as you're following your own aspirations, even if it can be aspirations that are coming from drinking spiritual wine and becoming intoxicated and screaming all day long, "God, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. All I want is to kiss you and to hold you and to reach to you and to be embraced by you, and I just want to melt into your life." Whose desire are you fulfilling? Your own desire. And therefore, even when you're going very, very high, you're not moving in terms of real moving, you're not going anywhere. But when Hashem says, "I put you in a body, and I reduce all your spirituality, I reduce you to having like not even one cell compared to angel." Yeah. But down in this world, you deal with the material things in this world. You eat and you sleep and you do business and you engage. And in the middle of these things, you give tzedakah. In the middle of these things, you help someone. You overcome your ego. You do it. "This is my will," God says. "This is what's so amazing to me. I love it. I get a thrill out of it when darkness converts to light." And you can only do it if you're in a physical body and you're engaging in the Gashmias. What I wanted the Meraglim, the Jewish people in the desert, to do, to go to the land of Israel, and they resisted. And they had all the reason to resist, but they missed the whole point. It's true, in the world of consciousness and in the world of experience, they accelerated to levels that no other person can ever accelerate. But God says, I'm giving you something way beyond your human consciousness. I'm allowing you to become me. Now, you're never going to be able to be conscious of it while you're in a body yet, only in the days of Mashiach. You're going to see what godliness you've reached. But only there is where we can actually move with an infinite distance. In heaven above, you can only go with finite increments. And therefore, you're never really touching in true infinity. You can only touch the infinite by living in the material world, dealing with the physical world according to God's will, and doing his mitzvot in the physical world. And this is what this man's, if you want to know a reason for it, it's because God desires the physical. And that doesn't make any sense. Why does God desire the physical? What does he get from darkness being converted to light? Why does that thrill him? We don't know. It doesn't make a difference. That's what he says. Gemiri. Gemiri means we have a tradition. We are taught this is the way it is, even though it doesn't make any sense to you. That what? That if you're holding on to something from them, which means if you're holding on to their worldview, where they wanted to be, you're living in the mindset of the people in the desert, you're not able to move. You can't become a mahalich. You're stuck. You're stuck in heaven. You're a prisoner of heaven. And heaven is still a limited, it's beautiful heaven, but it's still limited. And if you want to become unstuck, only way to do that is to follow Hashem's instructions. And where does Hashem want you? In your physical body, doing mitzvot in the middle of a physical life on a regular day without all this hoo-ha or whatever, and doing his will. So that was the story that he told him. Therefore, he had to leave go of this tzitzis from them. It was nice saying hello to these guys, bringing us the story that we should understand who this generation was. We don't have to look back at our ancestors and think that they were just a bunch of losers, but we can recognize and understand, wow, they were an awesome people. But we can also say, Ashreinu Matov Chelkenu, that we're the next generation who actually got to go into the land and fulfill God's will and do his whatever Hashem wants of us. But then to realize that what we are doing is way greater than all this incredible greatness that the generation of the Midbar had. That's our greatness, that we are able to fulfill Hashem's will, which that makes us into a real mover and a real goer. With that, we have a deeper explanation into this incredible. So all of this interpretation is from the Rebbe's notes, or called the Rishimus, that the Rebbe jotted down for himself. The Rebbe never spoke this in a sicha, but after Gimel Tammuz, they found amongst the Rebbe's, they found journals and journals of writings where he wrote for himself, and he has this pirush on this passage of the Gemara about the story of Rabbi Bar Chana. So and he demystifies it, or decodes this story to give us the inside story of which again, the point is that we think that to reach the ultimate enlightenment and ultimate freedom and ultimate liberation, we have to run away from the world. And the answer is totally opposite. We can only tap the essence of essence, which is infinitely higher than all of existence, only by delving into the world, not by running away from it. By delving into time and space, into our world, and making the world that we are living in godlier and holier, because that's where Hashem's intention is. Hashem wants to have a home in this physical world, even if we can't explain why. That's what it is. And for that purpose, he gave us all the mitzvot. And in that sense, let's celebrate the fact that we are physically alive, appreciate every moment, do as many mitzvot as we can, and recognize that this is where it's at. L'chaim u'l'bracha, everyone.